IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We're a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring a fresh perspective to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Welcome to All Things Policy. Before we get started on today's episode, I want to quickly talk about our awesome policy courses. We at the Takshashila Institution have education programs lasting one semester and 1 year that are tailored specifically for people like you. They're all online and you can take them from anywhere. Takshashila is, of course, an independent, non-partisan think tank and a school of public policy. Admissions are now open for our 12-week graduate certificate programs in public policy, defense and foreign affairs, technology and policy, and health and life sciences. There's also the postgraduate program in public policy. Programs begin on the 15th of January, 2022. The last date to apply to avail the 10% early bird scholarship is the 4th of December, 2021, and the application deadline is the 8th of January, 2022. You can visit our website at school.takshashila.org.in to find out more. I'm Aditya Ramanathan, and I'm joined by my colleague Suyash Desai today. And if you listen to our podcast or follow our work, you know that Suyash is one of the keenest observers and analysts of the PLA that you will find anywhere. And our task today is to talk about a new report from another set of keen observers of the PLA, the U.S. Department of Defense, which recently released its China Military Power Report. This is a report that comes out annually and every time makes a splash. One aspect of this report that has got a lot of attention recently is the expansion and strengthening of China's nuclear forces. China's nuclear forces were, you know, about 10 years back, a fairly boring area of study. That is absolutely not so anymore. Suyash, can you just broadly tell us what are some of the key takeaways from this report on China's nuclear weapons?
Hi, Aditya. Thanks for having me. Yes, it's a very interesting report. And that this is something that we wait for every year. And it's delayed this year and we are wondering when it is going to be released, because it's a very comprehensive document covering everything that has happened throughout the year with insights about what the government is thinking on Chinese military. Interesting thing about this report is that this is 2021 China report, military power report, which documents about the activities of the PLA in 2020. So every year it documents about the previous year. So there is a lot on India as well, because as we all are aware, the China-India standoff started in 2020. Before we talk about the specifics of nuclear, let us first discuss what are the basic issues of nuclear, and let us first refresh what are the basic issues, and then we could talk about specifics. So Aditya, in return, I would want to ask you, can you briefly tell us what are ICBMs, what are hypersonic missiles, what is a nuclear warhead, and what are MIRV technologies?
Sure, Suyash. So this used to be a fairly arcane field, like once again, about 10 years back. If you lived through the Cold War, I suspect some of these terms like MIRVs were actually household words. But here's the basic rundown of this. ICBM, or Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, is basically a long-range ballistic missile. A ballistic missile is sort of like throwing a stone in the air. So one phase of the ballistic missile's trajectory, it is powered by a rocket. After that, it basically uses space as a rapid transit medium through which to get to someplace further away near the Earth. Then it re-enters the Earth's atmosphere in its so-called terminal phase and strikes the target. Usually an ICBM, a warhead, would conduct an airburst over a target, though, you know, ground bursts and other types of modes of attack are also available. Now, what is a MIRV? MIRV stands for Multiple Independently Targetable Reentry Vehicles. MIRVs are basically the little warheads that you can fit onto an ICBM. So when an ICBM enters space during the so-called bus phase, it's moving as a single unit. Thereafter, the MIRVs actually separate from the rest of the body of the ICBM and make their own separate re-entries into the Earth's atmosphere. As I'm sure people know or have seen from movies and so on, at any time an object enters the Earth's atmosphere, you know, there's friction with the Earth's atmosphere and a great deal of heat is generated. And so the MIRV has to be capable of, rather like a spaceship, re-entering the Earth's atmosphere and guiding itself to its target and detonating. Typically, the MIRVs of the United States, Russia, and China will have thermonuclear warheads, which means they will have a fission device that actually sets off a fusion device, or a so-called hydrogen bomb. And theoretically, these can have yields of hundreds of kilotons. There are some, for example, agreements between the US and Russia to actually limit both the number of MIRVs and the yields of these warheads. China, we should note, is not a party to any of these treaties. So theoretically, a Chinese missile could have multiple MIRVs, each of them with yields of hundreds of kilotons exploding over targets. Now, ballistic missiles in general are obviously the most important part of any country's nuclear triad. Nuclear triad is simply a way of saying that you have three basic modes of delivery of nuclear weapons. You have air by fixed-wing aircraft, you have missiles that can be launched from land, and you have missiles that can be launched from the sea. So you have ICBMs and SLBMs, submarine launched ballistic missiles. Submarine launched ballistic missiles are essentially behave the same way as the land-based missiles broadly, in that they are ballistic missiles that use a lofted trajectory. They can have MIRVs that re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. The third leg are fixed-wing aircraft. For example, China uses the H-6N bomber as one of its potential modes of delivery of nuclear weapons. And in that sense, the nuclear forces of the Army, Air Force, and Navy together make up the triad of any country. Now, typically, your modes of delivery, as we've discussed, are either ballistic missiles or fixed-wing aircraft. You can also use cruise missiles, which are a bit like aircraft with that have warheads on them. They are powered throughout their flight. They travel at relatively lower altitudes and can maneuver and hit a target, but typically they have smaller payloads. So usually most cruise missiles today carry conventional rather than nuclear warheads. Now, of course, to add to this, we have so-called hypersonic missiles that have been in the news recently. China seems to have tested some sort of hypersonic device in July or August. And there is some sort of confusion about what exactly this is. Now, just to be clear, there's a lot of hype around the word hypersonic. Remember that a regular ICBM, for example, when it's re-entering the Earth's atmosphere, is traveling at hypersonic speeds. Hypersonic speeds are, you know, Mach 5, five times the speed of sound or above. They way exceed that. When we talk about hypersonic missiles today, we're broadly talking about two types of missiles. One are really fast cruise missiles, which typically have conventional warfare applications. And the other are so-called hypersonic boost glide missiles. The theoretical advantage of a boost glide is supposed to be that it uses a flatter trajectory. Basically, what we consider the dividing line between space and the Earth's atmosphere is the so-called Kármán line, which is about 100 kilometers above sea level. A boost glide missile typically travels within the Kármán line, travels within the Earth's atmosphere. And what that means is because it's not at that high an altitude, it can sort of hide behind the curvature of the Earth and move. That potentially means that your warning about this incoming missile might be delayed. There may be a delay in actually detecting it. That's at least the theory. Now, the problem, of course, is that with any such boost glide device, because it has to move through the Earth's atmosphere, it is naturally slowed down by that and needs not just a constant source of propulsion, but also needs a very effective guidance system in order to get it to its target. What the Chinese seem to have tested a little earlier this year is rather fascinating because the Chinese, just to be clear, say they were just testing a space plane. But according to the Americans, what the Chinese tested was, in fact, the so-called fractional orbital bombardment system that also used a hypersonic glide vehicle. Now, a fractional orbital bombardment system, or FOBS, is essentially a kind of spacecraft that completes only a partial orbit in the Earth's atmosphere. This particular missile or platform or whatever it was seems to have been launched from a regular Long March space rocket. After entering orbital space, this craft seems to have performed a partial orbit around the Earth, after which it deorbited, re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, behaved like a boost glide missile for a while, traveling through the Earth's atmosphere, and then reached its target. We don't know what happened after that. But what is really interesting about this is that it seems to be combining two different systems. It seems to be combining the fractional orbital bombardment system with the boost glide system. Now, boost glide systems were tested during the Cold War, but they were never really put into use. Fractional orbital bombardment systems were put into very limited use by the Soviets in the 1960s. Once again, theoretically, the idea of a FOBS was that since most of America's early warning systems, NORAD's early warning systems, pointed northwards towards the North Pole, because that's the natural route that any Soviet missiles or aircraft would take when they were attacking the continental United States. What a fractional orbital bombardment system could theoretically do is actually move the other way. It could take up an orbit that took it above the Earth's south pole, deorbit, and then attack the United States from the south, potentially leaving it without warning. Now, these were put into very limited use by the Soviets, I think partly because they recognized that the utility of such weapons are limited because the sheer difficulty of launching such a vehicle into orbit, then deorbiting it, means that the kind of payloads that a platform like this can carry are usually going to be smaller. It's also very difficult to MIRV such a system, unlike with an ICBM. So you're only going to have a single warhead. So the advantages are actually quite marginal. Now, what is different today is that because we have the ability to guide weapons with much greater precision, theoretically, it is possible to use hypersonic boost glide weapons that have much greater accuracy and potentially need much lower yield. Now, according to the Americans, this particular hypersonic boost glide vehicle that used a FOBS system was not all that accurate, but it's likely that the Chinese will keep testing and experimenting until they get really good at this. In fact, we should point out that Americans are testing their own boost glide systems that don't seem to use FOBS, but their own boost glide systems with which they plan to mount conventional attacks. So these are supposed to be conventional weapons that are highly accurate, rather like cruise missiles are today, and can, for example, hit a specific site or a specific building with a conventional warhead. So yeah, that's broadly what has been going on with China and the hype about hypersonic weapons. I don't personally think that hypersonic weapons are going to become central to China's nuclear deterrent, even if they are used to some extent. I think that what's far more significant about China's nuclear posture are the expansion of its triad. It's the fact that it's building more, SSBNs, which are ballistic missile nuclear submarines, and of course that it's expanding silos. Perhaps even more significant, Suyash, as you will point out, is that they have so-called hot swappable missiles that can use both conventional and nuclear warheads. But Suyash, I want to get back to you on the report itself, because earlier this year, once again, we got reports of China's new silos, and we'd even talked about those. Now, this report does seem to indicate that China is vastly expanding its nuclear arsenal. Can you tell us what evidence they're citing and where the expansion is actually taking place?
Thanks, Aditya. It was very comprehensive, all the specifications that you have mentioned. I'm sure our listeners will benefit a lot because all of this is very technical to understand at the first. So about the specifics of the report, I would point out at three or four important things that this report is highlighting. One, the SSBN capabilities and capacities. Two, the silos. Though there is a disclaimer that the reportage about silos came in 2021 and this report talks about 2020. That's number two. Three, that you've already mentioned about hypersonic missiles with the same disclaimer about 2021 developments, but the development started in 2020. And fourth, about hot swappable missiles and an increasing number of nuclear warheads. So going in this order, first about the SSBNs. As you have already mentioned about the nuclear triad, China is majorly land-centric nuclear force, and it is also trying to expand its navy and air force. Air Force being the least potent or capable right now of all three forces. It's SSB, that is ballistic missile submarines. China is planning to have eight ballistic missile submarines. I was surprised to see six ballistic missiles that are operational currently, according to DoD report. I was under the impression, I might be wrong here, but last time I checked, or I was under the impression there are four ballistic missile submarines that are being operated at two are under trial. So, according to the DoD report, six ballistic missile submarines are very well operational and they are based out of Hainan and functional in the three seas. Of course, there are specifications at time when they are operational, and some have, at least two of them have to dock in a particular period of time. But yes, that's the brief SSBN report, SSBN developments that are taking place. Also, they are moving towards the next generation. The next two, out of the eight SSBNs, the last two would be the next generation, that is type 096, which will have larger reach or capability, and which would also, the current lot of SSBNs are operating with JL-2 missiles, which the missile right now cannot reach the continental United States. If they are using a Bastion strategy from South China Sea, it is assumed that the JL-3, coupled with, which will be used with type 096, will be capable of reaching, the missile would be capable of reaching the United States if it crosses the first line of first chain islands, and it will be relative if it is relatively not deeper into the Pacific Ocean. That's an important development that China is working on since past so many years. So point number one, Type 96 SSBNs. This is something that China is moving towards. Point number two, I'll not go in the order that I had mentioned. That point number two is about the hot swappable missiles. So, and nuclear warheads. It has been often reported that China is increasing, doubling the number of nuclear warheads. China is tripling the number of nuclear warheads. All of this is speculation. But last DOD report mentions that China has a capacity to more than double its nuclear warheads by 2030. Now it is saying that it will reach 1,000 nuclear warheads by 2030, which is an increase on what it has mentioned previously. It is also increasing its land-based capacity, and the report also mentions that it is increasing the number of DF-26 missiles. A particular DF-26 is a MRBM missile. One important thing about DF-26 is that it is a hot swappable missile. That means a same missile could have or host a nuclear as well as conventional warhead. For instance, there are different versions of DF-21 missiles which could do either host a nuclear or conventional warhead. But due to such developments, there is a chance of unintended consequences, especially in case of an escalation in the near seas. So that is something important that we need to remember, that the warheads are increasing, though there is a tendency of DOD reports to hype up things, and which is natural because based on DOD report, budget, congressional, the defense ministry or the Pentagon demands to increase the budget in US Congress. So there is a tendency of hyping up the numbers, but the broader trend to remember, I don't know whether they have capabilities to go up to 1,000 nuclear warheads in less than 10 years time. But the broader trend to remember is that the number of nuclear warheads is increasing. That's point number two. And the technologies to host these warheads are also, they're developing the technologies to host the different technologies with longer reach to develop to host these warheads. That's point number two. The third important thing is that I'll continue on the thread that you had spoken. I'll take a thread from what you have spoken, Aditya. It's about the nuclear triad. So somewhere around 2019 or 2017, I don't remember the exact year, China started redeveloping its nuclear triad, the third part of its nuclear delivery systems, delivery strategy, posture, etc. So the Air Force, China, in a speech, Xi Jinping directed the Air Force to start redeveloping its capabilities to be capable of delivering a nuclear strike. It is believed that China's H-20N strategic bomber would be the third part of the triad with nuclear mission. The first vision of the first sight of this bomber, the first in 2019 military parade, this bomber was displayed for the first time. We don't know yet what is the station on what stage these bombers are being developed. It is not yet commissioned in any theaters or service, but we know that China is developing H-20N bombers to complete its triad. That's the third important point about China's nuclear development. Another thing that this report discusses is the strategy. Minor tweak to the strategy. This report specifically says that there is no first use, which we all already know. But this report also says that the ambiguity within China's nuclear doctrine is increasing. And those silos are the 2021 development, which obviously started in 2020. China started speaking those or thinking about those before 2020. But it indicates China's move to launch or not the complete force, but at least a partial move towards launch on warning posture. So these are important highlights from this report. Apart from that, other things are being repetitive, like what are the total force strike, what is the total size of the force, what are the different technologies that China has been developing over ages, what are the different missiles. These are the repetitive things that you can also find in 2019 report, but these four specific things are very important to highlight as developments in 2020, which China is thinking in its nuclear domain.
That's really interesting, Suyash, and I really want to get back to more about this. But before we do that, let's take a quick break. Welcome back. You know, Suyash, I was really struck by some of the language in the DoD report, specifically some of the talk about 1,000 warheads. Now, I'm not sure if 1,000 warheads means you're counting every MIRV. For example, if a DF-41 missile, which is a solid fuel missile that can carry 10 to 12 warheads, if you have 50 such missiles, you could potentially launch 600 such warheads, right? So that alone would account for more than half of the DoD's estimate. It's also interesting that the language that the DoD uses is that the PRC has possibly established a nascent nuclear triad. So, you know, they're acknowledging that China doesn't quite have that sort of triad at the moment, but is potentially getting there or has just about got there. The third point that was interesting, which you touched upon, was the idea that China could be moving towards a launch on warning posture. Now, this has been obviously very controversial, and Suyash, you have actually written extensively on this subject. Is there anything else in the DoD report that substantiates this claim that China could be moving towards launch on warning?
I think right now, a lot of it is based on the tunneling that they are doing and the silos that they are constructing, which indicates that a part of the force could be... And also based on certain exercises that they have done in the past 2 years, or readiness or combat related exercises that they are doing in the past few years, which provides them or which enables a part of the forces to be on alert all the time. All these things taken together or viewed together help us to see that it is partly moving its forces to launch on warning posture. But these are very flimsy, these are very weak evidences. But generally, as seen in the China, these evidences we have to do 2 + 2 = 5 to come to a conclusion, because generally a lot of things are not very apparent while, as you are already aware, while studying Chinese nuclear forces. So these are some instances or evidences to make NOW claim regarding China's nuclear forces.
Right. It is interesting to me how China's nuclear arsenal is being perceived by not just the United States, but also by India. One thing that has always struck me as sort of being in dissonance is that you use a launch on warning posture when you are afraid about the survivability of your nuclear arsenal. Now, Chinese are clearly concerned about that, which is why they are expanding this nuclear arsenal. Potentially, once you expand that arsenal and you have both hardened silos, you have mobile missiles, both of these on land, you have, you know, some air deliverable nukes, but more importantly, you have SSBNs, and you potentially have a reasonably secure bastion in the South China Sea for those SSBNs. And, you know, of course, like you pointed out, Suyash, the present crop of Chinese SLBMs cannot actually reach the continental United States, but that might change again in the next 10 years. So, It also seems, while, you know, there is this talk about a launch on warning posture, the Chinese are actually trying to make their nuclear arsenal more survivable. But it'll be really interesting to see how the Chinese square the idea of launch on warning with their profession of a no first use, because, you know, launch on warning essentially means, you know, to put it very crudely, launching your own missiles, launching your own attack before there are actual nuclear detonations. That is, launching them at a time when you believe nuclear use is imminent or is already underway. So, you know, it's not clear whether the Chinese are actually going in that direction with launch on warning or a so-called launch under attack type of posture. But, we should not rule out anything. China's nuclear forces, you know, like the rest of its military, are going through some really fascinating changes. And it's really hard for us to actually keep up and see what the Chinese are up to. So we should never be completely surprised by any changes that might occur, not just in the quantity or quality of their nuclear forces, but also in the way the Chinese think about nuclear weapons. So anyway, that was a great discussion, Suyash. We will, of course, keep following China's nuclear forces, China's conventional forces. This is a field that keeps on giving. We just absolutely love having these discussions here on All Things Policy. So thank you all for joining us. And thank you, Suyash, for telling us about this DoD report.
Thanks, Harit.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.